Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, editor-at-large at The Hub. I'm honored to be joined today by Tim Carney, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist at the Washington Examiner. He's also the author of the must-read new book, Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. I'm grateful to speak with him about the book, including the causes and consequences of a family-unfriendly culture and what individually and collectively we can do about it. Tim, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the book's thesis. What is a family-unfriendly culture? Give our listeners some color on what you mean.
I sort of divide it up into a few main areas. First, parenting culture right now just is out of control. That especially in middle-class, upper-middle-class circles, parents are putting in what they're doing, what I call maximum effort parenting. One piece of data I found was that while men, compared to the 1960s, dads have doubled the amount of time they put in, which is great. Women work outside of the home a lot more, which is great. Mothers still increased compared to our own mothers or grandmothers. Mothers today put in 50% more time into just solo parenting. So not, you know, not cooking dinner, not anything else like that. Just taking care of kids has gone up. And part of it is cultural expectations. The expectation that you have to helicopter your four-year-old, be there every single moment. The expectation that you can't let your 10-year-old go to the park alone. And some of it has to do with overambitious parenting, travel sports. I go into that. But beyond the parenting culture, there's also the mating and dating culture. You got dating apps these days. You have you just have a mindset towards marriage, which ends up delaying marriage, which ends up making people afraid of dating. Dating is going down. So that's totally broken. I spend a chapter or two on that. Finally, I think the values of our culture are family unfriendly. One example I always think of is parents who are bringing their baby on the plane feel they have to apologize. Often they bring a little goodie bag, you know, earplugs, a drink ticket, as if babies are somehow some unnatural abomination. And in general, just the mindset, well, you chose to have a kid. It's your problem. Don't impose a cost on any of the rest of us. That's part of the mindset that leads in our broader culture to a family-unfriendly culture.
We'll pursue those different lines of analysis over the course of our conversation. But before we do, I want to have you unpack something kind of implicit in your answer, which is, has our culture become less family-friendly over time? And if so, what do you think is behind that?
Yes. So there's a few reasons, a few bits of evidence you could find. One is that the birth rate in 2006 in the US was 2.1, and now it's way down to 1.6. And the economy was no better right before the Great Recession than it was right before, you know, the pandemic, for instance. And another thing is childhood anxiety is way up through the roof. You have an increased number of young adults who say they don't want to have kids, and an increased number of young adults who say they would like to have kids, but they just don't think it's in the cards. All of those things to me point to the fact that we have a culture that doesn't support people starting and then raising their families.
I want to ask about the role of expectations, including parental expectations, in your story. Tim, we have young kids, and this line of analysis resonated a great deal for me. At times, it can feel like we're part of an arms race in terms of the best extracurriculars and so on in order to pour into these kids what economists might call, quote, human capital. What do you think is behind that trend? And as a parent, how do you resist the temptation when you see everybody else doing it?
So the overambitious parenting the desire to give every kid the best of everything. It's some of it is just rooted in love and that the bottomlessness of parental love. But it really, I think, is a problem. One thing for the book, we conducted focus groups of men and women, separate groups, who don't have kids yet, but are on the fence about having children. And a couple, what the guys said, much more than the women, was, I just want to make sure that I can give them the best of everything. So I definitely don't feel ready to get married and start a family now, because I'd be afraid I'd just be giving them the bare minimum. Now, you know, the bare minimum, just enough calories to get by and like a rickety roof over their head is not optimal, sure. But I think that a lot of people feel these super high expectations. So that's one reason I find it a problem. I do think it delays family formation. So where does it come from and why? How do you overcome it? Some of it comes from social media. I mean, if you look at the momfluencers on Instagram, some of them are just giving helpful hints of like, hey, you know, I found that this vacuum cleaner actually works better than this vacuum cleaner. I found that even though my kids don't like this healthy dish, I put in this one thing and they're more like, so, you know, how to get your kids to eat a spinach smoothie, some of that. But a lot of the momfluencers are demonstrating sort of this perfect household. And they pretend that it's not all exquisitely crafted and posed and makeup, and that it's just, oh, here's a, and it makes a lot of women feel totally, it affects women the most, totally inadequate. A lot of it comes, I think, actually in a self-reinforcing sort of feedback loop. Smaller families leads to more overzealous parenting, which leads to smaller families and so on. And I even quote in Family Unfriendly the sociologists who say, you know, the West, America, Canada, Europe are choosing quality over quantity. And that drives me crazy, not just because my wife and I chose quantity, we have six kids, but because I don't think it is quality. I think there are real bad outcomes from this overambitious parenting, including childhood anxiety.
Tim, let's stay on that subject because it was something I thought a lot about as I read the book. That is the direction of causality between a family-unfriendly culture and declining birth rates. On one hand, the extent to which a family-unfriendly culture discourages families from having children is pretty intuitive. But on the other hand, as you say, there is a question about the extent to which low birth rates themselves contribute to a family-unfriendly culture, in the sense that the fewer kids we have means that we're not only just less kid-child-centric as a society, but also puts even more pressure on parents to make the fewer kids that we have count in a bit of a perverse way. Talk a bit more about how a family-unfriendly culture is contributing to a lower birth rate, but also how it's interacting in the other direction, too.
So I gave one specific reason, which is over-intensive parenting is both a cause and an effect of lower, smaller families. But another great example, or terrible example, shows up in South Korea, the country with the lowest birth rate in the world. And there have been multiple news accounts in different major newspapers about how it's proliferating the number of child-free spaces. Not that there are no children, but children aren't allowed. And so you just go through your daily life without thinking of children and you get annoyed by it. It makes me think of Capitol Hill. I work in Washington, D.C. A lot of the laws are written by the young staffers. If the young staffers live walking distance from the, or, you know, they ride a Metro or an Uber into work, they live in a hip neighborhood, they work on Capitol Hill, they might not see children all day. So when they're writing a law, they have in their mind only the adults of our species. And so that sort of thing, if the policymakers on the local, on the federal level, aren't seeing children and thinking about it, they're going to think, oh, well, we don't really need a sidewalk on both sides of the street. Why would you need that? And I mean, that's honestly what happens in a lot of our suburbs in the D.C. area. And I just think the people who were building it, it's not just that kids aren't in the front of their mind. Kids aren't even in the back of their mind. You forget about them. And so it becomes this spiral. And so if you live in a neighborhood where nothing is child friendly, well, you're going to think, okay, I have to move out of this neighborhood before I have kids. And that, of course, is going to delay and family formation.
You write that it takes a village to raise a family, which intersects with your last book, Alienated America, which in the line of Putnam's famous book, Bowling Alone, documented the decline of civil society and community. For parents in particular, what are the consequences of lost community? How has it affected the raising of children and ultimately contributed to a culture that's unfriendly to families?
Every parent knows that they rely on other adults. Sometimes it's because the nuclear family is so important. Mother, father, kids, so absolutely essential to the people involved, to the broader society. It's sometimes easy to assume that this necessary thing is also sufficient and that, well, that's all that's needed. And when Hillary Clinton wrote her book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child, Rick Santorum, who's a guy I agree with a lot, he wrote a book called It Takes a Family. The book was basically right, but the sort of the tone of that comeback was, no, you don't need a village. And what he didn't mean, so I'm not making this about Santorum, but just about the tone of that back and forth. What we can't believe is that two parents are enough to raise a kid or multiple kids. We need coaches. You need teachers. You need mentors. To even get married and have kids, you often need somebody you can look at and say, okay, that looks hard, but I can do it. To have your second or third kid, you definitely need somebody like that. My wife and I, we raise our kids Catholic, and you know, we need a parish. We need Catholic schools. You need a T-ball team. You need babysitters whom you can trust. For a lot of people, the ideal village, and if you think Hillary Clinton was quoting an African proverb and then sort of the historic sense, the village meant extended family. So one of the points of research I found that made me laugh, but also struck me as really important while I was working on this book, parents' proximity to, you know, grandma, to their own mother or mother-in-law, predicts whether they'll have another child. If grandma helps out with your kid, or if you can at least go over and have dinner there on Sunday nights, you're more likely to keep having children. And I think it has to do with the fact that raising children is just naturally, as a species, not meant to be done alone. Parenting is exhausting when they're really young and they're not rational human beings. You need to interact with rational human beings. And if it's just the two of you and you're exhausted, it can be totally isolating and you can think you're going insane. And you need to, I mean, this is one of the reasons Jim Gaffigan is such a hit as a comedian, is he just tells the parents again and again, yeah, this, you kind of are going insane, but it's okay. You're not the crazy ones. But, and so that, all of that, if anybody needs community, anybody needs support from outside of the household, it's parents. And Bowling Alone, Robert Putnam, 25 years ago, wrote about how people are less connected. You mentioned Alienated America. I sort of updated that in 2019. People belong to fewer things. And lots of negative consequences tumble down from that. But I think the biggest one is making family formation harder and making fewer people do it.
The book outlines a lot of data and evidence on the rise of anxiety and other psychosocial challenges facing modern children. Tim, talk about the interrelationship between those developments and a family-unfriendly culture. How has the broader culture contributed to what are alarming trends for our kids?
Yeah, so the U.S. government, the Biden administration, joined with a lot of public health authorities and said we actually have an epidemic of childhood and adolescent anxiety. And following that, there was an op-ed in a Journal of Pediatrics that said the root of this is in the lack of independent play by children, not supervised by adults. As normal people would put it, kids don't just get to run around anymore. Run around the neighborhood, ride your bike, play pickup basketball. Nobody has to bring you there. Nobody has to coordinate. I tell the story in my book about me and my friends coordinating pickup football in middle school and high school. And this was one of my favorite memories. But we also had to like learn the skills of getting eight guys, making the phone calls. You had to get there. The only contribution our parents had to do was tell us to take off our muddy clothes on the back porch before we stepped in the house. And that independent play wasn't just fun. A, it gave parents a break, but B, it also really reduced it. Well, the lack of it, it seems to be increasing childhood anxiety, according to the experts who are studying this. And so that's the main way in which a family-unfriendly culture contributes, is if parents are supposed to or have to drive their kid to every event, well, and that everything's going to be run by a coach, et cetera. There are virtues to that. But right now we have a real deficit of independent play by children. So some of this is about infrastructure, sidewalks, bike lanes, et cetera. Some of this is about the signs up on the field, no play without a permit, which drives me crazy. You know, they shut down some of the baseball fields, you know, the day that the baseball season ends to protect their precious little fields. And it's there's so many things that keep kids from just running around, playing pickup sports with their friends, exploring in the woods, et cetera. And I'd cite the sociological data, but I also think it just comes down to, it makes childhood less fun. Not everything needs to show up on a chart. We can just say it's less fun if you have to sit at home or you're always being coached.
Hi, Hub Podcast listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub, with a special announcement. Over the coming weeks on our publishing platform, including this podcast feed, we are going to be bringing attention to the growing government subsidization of news journalism in Canada. It will be possible this year for many digital news outlets to access government funding for up to 50% of the salaries of their journalists. We think this is a problem. Public trust in the media is already at all-time lows. More government subsidies doesn't make this any better. In fact, government subsidies raise questions, legitimate ones, for listeners and news consumers like you. Can you trust news organizations that are taking large government supports to underwrite the cost of their journalism? Will they hold the powerful, including government, to account? Here at The Hub, we do not take government funding. We made this decision because we think it's important to our independence, to our credibility with you, our listeners and readers. Creating news and original content is expensive, time-consuming, and depends on people like you becoming paid subscribers. You can do that right now on our website, www.thehub.ca. Thank you in advance for your generous support. Now let's get back to our program.
You're a bit skeptical in the book that the solution to a family-unfriendly culture runs through public policy. There are certainly areas where public policy can change things on the margins, but you're fundamentally talking about cultural change for which the relationship with public policy is complex, with long lag times, etc. So what is the book's theory of cultural change? How do you go from subcultures like your T-ball league at your Catholic parish to influencing the broader culture? Or Tim, is that even the right way to think about these issues?
I think you're right that it's very hard and it takes a very long time. So on the public policy front, I would ask, if somebody says, would this pro-family or pro-natal policy make us more family friendly? My first question back to them would be, do you see it changing the culture? And I just don't see large piles of money, you know, tripling the child tax credit, changing the culture. It will make a couple people on the margin a little more likely to have a second or a third kid, and that's good, but it's not going to be transformative. What can change the culture is going to be 10,000, 100,000 institutions of civil society. It's going to be, you know, a town government that paves the sidewalks, that makes sure that there's events for stay-at-home moms every day of the week, that goes ahead and as they're making changes, puts children and families first. It's going to be churches. I talk a lot about how every church should see the falling birth rate as an absolute crisis. And that especially, you know, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faiths that really value parenthood and that value children, they ought to say, wait, are we doing anything to get in the way of our people having kids? And are we doing enough to support them? And so that would be a cultural change, just sending the message. And this is possible because of the subcultures that we see this happening in. The Latter-day Saints and the Mormons in Utah and Idaho. I visited some modern Orthodox Jewish communities in Maryland where I used to live. I go over to Israel. And you see there are cultures and subcultures that do it. How do we get from where we are now to there? That's incredibly complicated. Part of it is, I think, just every little bit creates positive momentum. Like we were talking earlier, the causal arrow points in both directions. So making the world a little more family friendly creates more momentum to change a broader culture.
Staying on the topic of theories of cultural change, one of my favorite parts of the book is when you actually strip things down to a first principles level and almost set out a Tim Carney anthropology of the person. Why don't you talk a bit about what you're aiming to get at in that part of the book? And why it's important for understanding how we can individually and collectively build family-friendly cultures around us.
I think it's funny that you use the adverbs individually and collectively, because that's a tension in the human person, right? We are fundamentally, on some level, individuals, and individualism is a core part of, I think, why a lot of people left Europe and came over to this side of the Atlantic. And it's a key part of our virtues. But right now, in a lot of ways, we're too individualistic. And by too, I don't mean too individualistic for my tastes. I mean, out of sync with our nature. We are by nature relational beings. We are people who, if you try to describe somebody, you're usually describing who they are in relation to someone else. Oh, that's Zeb's dad. Oh, you know, he's my second cousin. Oh, he's the guy who, you know, who replaced Dave at the office or whatever. We have relations to other people is who we are. It's how we play a role along with other people in institutions. And so that means that if we're doing it right, we grow dependent on other people. I think the spirit of the day, the family unfriendly spirit of the day, it preaches that dependency is a pathological weakness and that autonomy is the goal we need to strive for, the good we need to hold on to with all our tightness and with all our strength, and that really cuts against human nature. I'm a Christian, a Catholic. I believe that we are made in the image of God. But in the book, I don't sort of lay on the dogma heavily, but I do believe that we do need to say, you know, people are good regardless of their accomplishments. So I end chapter one, which talks about stuff like travel sports, et cetera, by talking about a disabled nephew of mine or another relative of mine who has Down syndrome, and just saying, anybody who sees these people knows, oh, this is beautiful. This girl with Down syndrome doing a dance that's out of step, out of sync, but with all her heart. Everybody who watches that knows that that's beautiful. That ought to teach us a lesson about what we're trying to do as parents. Are we a failure? Is our kid a failure if they don't make the JV squad? And so that ought to inform our anthropology, our view of ourselves.
You mentioned that you're a Catholic and that you have your own faith commitments. One of the more interesting parts of the book is when you discuss going to Israel to interview both religious and secular Jews, and the extent to which the country's religious foundations have contributed to a culture in which even secular Jews have a higher birth rate than Canada, the U.S., and elsewhere. It prompts the question, Tim, how much of this is ultimately a secularization issue? And apart from some kind of revival, is there an inherent limit to recreating a family-friendly culture in a more secular world?
So first of all, I'm glad you mentioned I spoke to secular Jews. This one guy who in Israel who was saying, oh, it's we have way too many kids in this country. And he was like literally pointing at Jerusalem and cursing the religious folk as he was playing soccer with his 4-year-old. And in the middle of this conversation, his 2-year-old ran up and he picked her up. And I just saw what a great country. The sort of anti-family people have 2 kids. And, you know, hopefully he's had another since then. And so the reason that's important is that the culture in Israel is religious. And what it does is it builds a culture that's family friendly in a way that affects the non-religious. Things like, as one man said to me, the bus drivers in Israel have an affection for little children. And all this sort of infrastructure, you know, people expect you to have kids, just those expectations. Now, sometimes from, you know, a Jewish mother, it's a demand that you have kids, but also just in general, it's an expectation that it's normal to have kids. And so and not just have them, but have them with you. If you show up, if I give a speech at a conference in Washington, D.C., it wouldn't be normal for me to bring kids. But if I did it in Jerusalem or even Tel Aviv, which is much more secular, it would be normal. And so you imagine all these little things that get set up, a bunch of houses get built, and a kindergarten and a playground will be built where kids can get to them without having to cross the street. And all of that trickles down from the religion. So the question then would be, could a culture gain that same love, dedication, accommodation of children without a religious core? And I don't know of any that have. So I don't want to say it can't happen, because I don't know that Europe is going to, especially not, Southern Europe, the nominally Italian part of Europe, I don't know that they're going to have a religious revival. I think the United States could. I don't know enough about Canada's culture, but in the U.S., we're a religious country, even though we're declining in religion, just in our heart. We've had great awakenings multiple times in our history. I do think that's the best hope for restoring a family-friendly culture, but I would love for somebody to point me to a secular, broader culture that does what it says. It says, send us your kids. We're going to accommodate them. We're going to go out of our way because we believe that it's in our relations to one another that we're fully human.
Like a lot of millennials, I'm married to an ambitious and successful woman who loves being a mom, but also aspires to have a career in which she finds meaning and purpose. How much at the end of the day is a discussion about family unfriendly culture really about helping modern women not feeling like they're making major trade-offs with their families and their careers?
Well, so absolutely. I have about two chapters on work. One of the points I make is that the efforts so far to make in the U.S. and in Northern Europe, especially, to make work and family go together better have mostly subsidized work. they've been trying to, instead of form family-friendly workplaces, formed work-friendly families. And that is, so things that in their own are good, you know, a subsidy for childcare or more generous maternity and paternity leave. These end up not helping people get their desired family size. Americans are still way short of what they say their ideal family size is on average. They do lead to people working more. So I try to offer a different vision of family-friendly workplaces, which starts with the idea that some bosses might hate, some capitalists might hate, but the company saying your family is the most important thing. Now, if you're married, that means your wife or your husband. If you have kids, it means your spouse and your kids. If you don't, it might mean your brothers and your parents. And if you're an only child who's moved away from your parents and doesn't have a wife or a kids, maybe you'll feel, wait, that's not fair. Why should we accommodate family? And that's the sort of uncomfortable thing where I have to say, I'm sorry, we'll accommodate you somewhat. Do you have a pet? Do you have a favorite soccer team? We'll try to accommodate that, but we're going to accommodate family more because that's actually more important. So that's stepping away from this sort of symmetry, an idea of being totally neutral on everything, and into something saying, this is something we're going to value more, especially as Americans are falling short on it. And so one of the ways, there's a term workplace ally that gets used a lot, that men need to be workplace allies to women. The main reason, according to the best economists, that women in the U.S. get paid a little bit less for the same work than men is because mothers demand more flexibility. My answer is men need to demand that flexibility to be home with their kids. If mothers are getting paid less than fathers because mothers are saying, well, I want to make sure, I want to have a job that allows me to leave if my kid comes home sick, or I want to be able to work from home on Fridays and be off the clock at 3 p.m. Those are things that dads should be demanding too. So that's my sort of family-friendly feminist workplace that makes it normal for women to have those demands for family first.
We've talked already a bit about the rise of delayed family formation in Canada, the U.S., and elsewhere, and the extent to which it's contributing to not just lower birth rates overall, but as you said in your last answer, lower birth rates than families and women in particular tell pollsters that they themselves want. What, Tim, can we do to better enable people to start families earlier and in turn have the size of families that they ultimately aspire to?
I think that's a great question, because saying people should get married earlier than they do was a sort of unpopular thing in elite circles. And obviously, there are people who err on the side of their subcultures where divorce is really high, parts of the military, enlisted men, because they, I'm going to go off to war, I'm going to get married, it's not considered. So you can certainly err on the side of being rash and rushing into marriage. I think there's a virtuous middle, and that we're well past that. Just when I got married in 2006, my wife at age 25 was the average age of marriage. now it's basically 29 for women. So that's a not very long time period for it to get pushed back that far. So, and some of that is just due to women having more education. There are some schools, Catholic University of America here in DC is doing what it can to accommodate mothers as students and graduate students as well. BYU, Mormon school, accommodates a lot of mothers as undergraduates with lots of flexibility. There's also just the fact that men, a lot of men who like really plan out their career, don't think about planning out their family life. So my AI colleague, Brad Wilcox, he just wrote a book called Get Married. And he talked about one of his research assistants, a graduate student, and who was saying, well, here's like the next three moves I want to make with my career. He's like, okay, that's good and ambitious. What is your plan for getting married? And the guy was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you said you wanted to get married and have kids, right? Yeah, I do. But you can't just plan that out. You can't perfectly plan anything. I mean, I'm kind of an anti-planner, is one of the things I talk about in the book, but I had a strategy. I moved into a bachelor pad and I threw a party every month, knowing that, and told all my friends to bring their friends. And that meeting a friend of a friend in my house was the most likely way for me to meet my wife. And I did. And now we have six kids and two dogs. And so having some sort of strategy, so that should be part of our education. Hey, not everybody has to get married, but if you want to get married and have kids, you have to think about how you're going to do it. What city do you want to live in? Even what college do you want to go to? How are you going to build your social life? How are you going to make sure you live in a neighborhood that has other, there are all sorts of ways. And then to redirect people towards the idea of marriage, that dating is ultimately pointing towards marriage. That all of those things, I think, would help young people get married sooner without needing to crack a whip that you have to get married. But all of those things would help young people get married sooner. And then you have to convince them, do not wait till you're ready to have kids, because you will never be ready to have kids.
Even more so in Canada than the United States, Tim, there is a hyper-concentration of investment and employment in a relatively small number of major cities, which tends to force people to relocate from their extended families in pursuit of their professional aspirations. And in so doing, breaks the intergenerational relationship that we talked about earlier. Is there a possibility in your mind that the ongoing prevalence of hybrid or remote work enables something of a revival, a resurgence of intergenerational relationships and possibly even intergenerational living? And if so, what might the consequences be for our family-unfriendly culture?
So hybrid remote work cuts in all sorts of interesting directions. For one thing, it's what parents need. But on the other hand, I know that when my workplaces were remote, even to the degree that they're still a little bit more remote than pre-pandemic, it really does harm the younger people. Work or going downtown, at least, is how you meet other people. B, professionally, my exposure, I got to work for Bob Novak, who's an amazing journalist. I got to work for Terry Jeffrey, another great journalist. And my exposure to them, the bosses, or the guys who were slightly above me, where I was like, oh, I could be that guy in 2 years. That face-to-face exposure to them was very important. On the other hand, to make enough money to justify your college education, you have to move to an expensive city. Well, that's obviously a family-unfriendly arrangement. And so if you are able to get a decent job in your hometown, then that could better distribute, put young people in places where they can afford life. And if they have kids, grandma's still there around the corner. So I'm not enough of a prophet to predict what will happen with remote work, but it definitely cuts in lots of interesting directions.
Final question. How will we know if the culture becomes more family friendly? What are the signs that we should be looking for?
So I joke that what I want is 9 months after family friendly publishes for there to be a baby boom. So that's Christmas 2024. And maybe Taylor Swift and Jason Kelsey or Travis Kelsey can kick that off. But so you'll see more babies being born. Right now, we have fewer children in the U.S. than we did 10 years ago. I think that's true in Canada as well. I think you'll see less stressed parents and less stressed children. But let me talk about the birth rate. The birth rate hides a lot of stuff. I think what you referred to earlier, I think a family-friendly culture would see people getting married on average in their 20s again, rather than in their 30s. I think you would see people more likely to have three children. Right now in the U.S., the ideal number of children is 2.7 in the average poll, while the actual number of children is below 1.7. So just the closing of that gap would be the first step. I ideally would want the ideal to move higher, but the absolute first step is the closing of that gap between actual family size and ideal family size.
Well, we'll have to look ahead to see if the book ultimately has that type of causal effect. But in the meantime, I'd encourage people to read it. It's called Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Tim Carney, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. Thehub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Speer. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Speer, the Hub's editor-at-large. This episode was produced by Amal Atter-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.